Hello, my name is Mark O'Connell. This is number 0285, the Stuff File Programme with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following programme is brought to you in living colour.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Programme with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0285. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Scott Michaels, who's the founder of Dearly Departed Tours, a bus tour that features the dark side of Hollywood. How did this all get started?
The tour started because I assembled what I thought a nice tour would be for people that wanted to come to Los Angeles and see the more odd things, and, you know, not oohing and aahing over Brad Pitt's hedges or something like that, but the more juicier items, I suppose. The things I wanted to see, murder locations, things like that. Not in a, ooh, yay, they're dead kind of a way, celebrating the fact that they're dead, but just satisfying the curiosity and, you know, taking people to the news. That's basically how I started it, and that was 10 years ago.
Relationship coach Frank Kerman is back on to talk about the minefield that is Valentine's Day.
Whether it was created by a corporation to make money or it truly was related to various religions or groups that want to celebrate something, I just look at what it is right now. And right now, if you're in a couple, it is a reminder to celebrate what you have with your partner. That's all I see Valentine's Day as. It's a reminder that if you're in a relationship, to take a few minutes, take an evening to appreciate your partner. Now, how you do that is completely up to you.
Science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back on the show to talk about several space science issues, including the recent near miss we had from an asteroid.
It never posed any danger to us here on Earth. It did pass 1.2 million kilometers away from us at its closest point, but that is considered an astronomical squeaker. It really is, because it is the largest space rock known to us in catalog to have passed in a while, and will be so until the year 2027, when another space rock will be coming in our direction.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0285 was Mark O'Connell, an animator and film reviewer in the UK. You can check out his website, his review website, at film-reviews.net. That's film-reviews.net. And you can also go to his other website, markoconnell.com, and check out his caricatures and even order your very own. So there you go. Thank you very much, Mark, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And by the way, you can also find the links, I forgot to mention, to Mark's website by going to this week's show page, which you heard Mark mention the number of, 0285. Just go to the What's On page, and you'll find the links to Mark's site. And again, thank you very much, Mark, for doing the guest slate on this program. And as I said, a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A generous resident in South Oakland, Pennsylvania, whose name has been withheld, was in a seasonal spirit the week before Christmas. Now, she invited a pregnant, homeless woman that she had met at a Rite Aid store to her home for a hot shower, a change of clothes, and a warm bed for the night. The resident was forced to call police, though, when she went to check up on her guest and discovered her engaging in sexual activity with the resident's pit bull.
And they called it puppy love.
Yes. The guest, enraged at being caught, vandalized the home before officers arrived to arrest her. Yikes. Okay, let's be honest. Now you're curious as to whom the father of her baby could be.
Oh, I guess they'll never know.
Moving right along, Kathy Fedden filed a $30 million wrongful death lawsuit in December against Suffolk County, New York police after her 29-year-old son, driving drunk in 2013, fatally crashed into an office. She reasons that her son's death is the fault of the police officer who stopped him earlier that evening and who must have noticed that he was already drunk but did not arrest him. The officer, who knew the son as the owner of a popular with police local delicatessen, merely gave the son a lift home. But the son later drove off in his mother's car in which he had the fatal crash. That's two stories in a row now where no good deed apparently goes unpunished. And I mean, the cop drives him home instead of arresting him, and now the lawsuit has been filed against the police department? But wait a minute. The son died driving the car belonging to his mother, who is filing the suit against the county. Perhaps the county should countersue her for not making sure that her drunk son couldn't drive off in her car. After all, turnabout is fair play when it comes to idiotic lawsuits, don't you think? Yeah. Elsewhere, you know, there are some dim bulbs when it comes to criminals. Here's a couple of them. Number one, 32-year-old Shane Lindsay allegedly robbed a Citizens Bank in New Kensington, Pennsylvania on January 14th and ran off down the street, but he was arrested about 15 minutes later a few blocks away, having stopped off at Easer's Restaurant and Deli to order chicken and biscuits. Well, I guess crime can give you an appetite. And story number two, 19-year-old Jeffrey Ward was arrested in the act of robbing a 7-Eleven in Northeast Washington, D.C. on January 10th because two plainclothes police detectives were in the store at the time, though the police badge of one of them was hanging on a chain around her neck. As soon as the man announced, "This is a stick-up," the detective drew her gun and yelled, "Stop playing! I got 17," meaning a gun with 17 bullets. Well, I'm guessing he stopped playing. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, under federal law in the United States, if a state court convicts a non-citizen of a crime relating to federally controlled drugs, that non-citizen can be deported. Now, that's how Munez Mlawli's sock got all the way to the Supreme Court's docket. He had stashed four Adderall pills in his sock, and when he got busted, he pleaded guilty to having drug paraphernalia. That would be the sock. The federal government is trying to deport him. He's a university professor, by the way. Because of the sock, asked Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Kansas law apparently states that if you put drugs in something, it's paraphernalia. And the lawyer for the federal government told the court, all paraphernalia convictions of aliens justify deportation. This is what Justice Elena Kagan said. He had four pills of Adderall. If you go to half the colleges in America and just randomly pick somebody, that person has Adderall, she said. Well, you know, when you put it that way, it kind of makes you wonder how this case worked all the way up to the Supreme Court in the first place. I mean, it's often said that the war on drugs is a war on people. And now apparently it's people and their socks. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Scott Michaels is the founder of Dearly Departed Tours, a multimedia Hollywood bus tour that features the dark side of Hollywood. But Scott also does something that's very special for some departed Hollywood actors who have been buried without recognition. Scott joins us on the line right now from Hollywood to talk a little bit about it. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for taking the time to do this with us this evening. I want to start off by talking a little bit about Dearly Departed Tours before we get to what some of the work you've been doing. How did these tours get started, and what will people see when they go on these tours?
Well, the tour started because I assembled what I thought a nice tour would be for people that wanted to come to Los Angeles and see the more odd things, and, you know, not oohing and aahing over Brad Pitt's hedges or something like that, but the more juicier items, I suppose, the things I wanted to see, murder locations and things like that, not in a ooh, yay, they're dead kind of a way, celebrating the fact that they're dead, but just satisfying the curiosity and, you know, taking people to the news. That's basically how I started it, and that was 10 years ago.
And how popular have the tours become?
Well, we're certainly become part of the landscape in Los Angeles. People know who we are. So, and we've been running. We ran through. We've been continually going since even when we fell in rough financial times. The country. So, you know, I think there's a degree of success in longevity, and we've achieved that.
And what are some of the things that people are more curious about when it comes to some of the things that you have on your tour?
Well, the things that are the most notorious things, the crimes that we're still talking about, you know, the Black Dahlia, that happened, you know, 50, 60 years ago, or the Menendez murders, the things that are so extreme and almost unthinkable. I have a tour that's devoted strictly to the Tate-LaBianca murders, or most people refer to them as the Manson murders. So, you know, these are fantastic crimes, and not in a positive sense, but just, you know, they're better than any script that you could write, and it's real life. And I think that some people have been, you know, studying these things, and there's been multiple movies and documentaries made about them, and to actually see them in person is pretty it's pretty interesting.
Over the years, have you had reaction from the Hollywood community?
Mostly positive, to be honest with you. I was sort of hesitant to. I'm always hesitant if someone introduces themselves and they know who I am. I often wonder, you know, how is this going to go? And it's very rarely does it go negatively. And I think the biggest surprise to me fairly recently was when I met the younger sister of Sharon Tate. Her name was Deborah Tate, the last surviving member of her immediate family. And I was introduced to her very nervously and shook her hand. And she actually embraced me. She said, "I'm not a shaker, I'm a hugger." And said, "I know who you are." And she, you know, I don't think she gave me her blessings, but she was kind about it. And I think she understands what we do from a historic perspective.
And what I alluded to in the introduction is something else that you also do. You recognize, or at least help recognize, some people who in Hollywood have been buried without recognition. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, because a lot of my friends and I, before the internet, we used to hang out in cemeteries. We all thought we were the only ones. You know, we liked cemeteries. We liked finding celebrities in cemeteries. It was sort of like a fun kind of a treasure hunt, almost, if you will. And when the internet came about, we got to know each other, and we formed little, you know, organizations. That sounds so sophisticated, but we'd get together and we'd go to, you know, graveyards and things like that. And a few years ago, I started a Dearly Departed Weekend, which is a two-day event that are usually held in unusual places. We had one held at the cocktail party at the Los Angeles County Coroner, a dinner at the Mountain View Mausoleum, and we'd get guest speakers, and we had a raffle, and I decided that a good point, because we all know each other through these things, and quite frankly, I have a business that runs on the misfortune of others. I thought making it karmically a little bit better and buying a tombstone for someone who's been in an unmarked grave, that people, you know, battled for recognition in their lives. And I didn't think it was right that they'd be in these anonymous plots in cemeteries. So we used the proceeds from these weekend events to purchase tombstones for the actors that are unmarked.
Now, are there a large number of Hollywood actors whose gravestones, or grave sites rather, are unmarked?
There's a fair amount. Now, some people are by choice. There is, say, for instance, Frank Zappa or Roy Orbison or George C. Scott. Their families have chosen the anonymity. I think it has to do with, you know, fans, or maybe just, you know, maybe they're cheap and they just don't want to buy one. I don't know, but it's family's wishes. In the case with the ones that we're establishing, they mostly were people that died without family, and some of them died from at the Motion Picture Country Home, which is a retirement home for actors and people in show business. It's like a nursing home almost, and the Motion Picture Fund has graves around Los Angeles in different cemeteries. They own portions of cemeteries. So when someone dies at the Motion Picture Country Home, they will provide them a space, but they won't provide them a tombstone because, quite frankly, it's expensive. And so there are a lot of people in unmarked graves. You know, we're not talking the Clark Gables, and we're not, you know, people like that, people that had plenty of success, financial and otherwise, in Hollywood. But these are people that are sort of the the supporting players, I guess you could say.
The journeyman actors and actresses that we see from film to film, but maybe don't even know their name, but recognize their faces.
Right. It's a lot of that, oh, yeah, that's that guy from The Thing, you know, that one. It's a lot of that sort of thing. And we do try to do it within a theme, like last year, because I didn't know the people. You know, I know their roles, what they were famous for, or what they did in their careers. Now, last year we had the dinner, the one of our events at the dinner at the Pasadena Mausoleum, and in that mausoleum was George Reeves, who was Superman, who killed himself in 1959 in Beverly Hills. Now, the person we chose to mark that year was Jonathan Hale, and Jonathan Hale was an actor who was most famous for being in a show called Blondie. He played Dagwood Bumstead's boss in the Blondie show, and in a couple of the movies. But he also starred in a few episodes of Superman, so it kind of worked with the George Reeves thing. You know, that's how we chose Jonathan Hale that year. So it usually has to do with something striking a chord on some level. You know, somebody that you see a film and you think, wow, that person was kind of cool. And you do a little bit of searching, and you find out, wow, they're just there, unmarked. So it feels good to do it. It really does. It feels like I'm, giving back a little bit.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of the people that are on unmarked graves just didn't have any family. But have you had the opportunity to come in contact with some family of gravestones that you've purchased?
No.
No.
No, it's never come about. I know in some cases I've come to find out later on that they do exist, that are family that do exist, but no, no one's ever come to me. And actually just this week, because the person that we marked this year was Thelma Pelish, a character actress called Thelma Pelish. Just the other day I got a phone call from someone who was a dear friend of hers. That's the first time I've ever heard of anyone from anyone having to do with any of the people that we purchased markers for.
Well, it is a very honorable thing that you are doing. Do you plan to keep doing this in the future? And is it one a year, or are you planning to do more, or what?
Well, it's just something. It's funny that we've just been doing this, and it's never been something that's been so like contrived. It just sort of came natural. We just started doing it, so. I am proud of it, but I guess I didn't do it for any kind of accolades. I did it because I think Hollywood's a wonderful place, and these people help put it on the map, and they deserve better than that. So you know, I'll do as many as I can. Of course, we scrape together a few hundred dollars to do these things once a year, so it's not like we have unlimited funds. But I like doing what we do. And it makes me feel good, and it makes everyone who contributes feel good. So we'll certainly continue.
Do you add the actors that you have added tombstones for to your tours?
That hasn't come up yet, to be honest with you. That's so funny. I should actually look at that as a possibility in the future. But no, that has never come up. They just they get a place of honor. A nice photograph on the wall in our shop, and that's about the extent of it. And a marker we go visit.
And people, if they want to find out more about the tours, they can go to your website, which is dearlydepartedtours.com. Correct?
That's right. We're on Facebook too, and yeah, that's us.
And people will find out all the information as to times of the tours and when they take place, and all that fun stuff. Can they also book the tours?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we run 7 days a week, and on our regular tour, you'll see about 70 different locations where deaths and scandals happen all around L.A. So, we run every day. The Helter Skelter tour is devoted to the Pate LaBianca or the Manson murders. That goes out on weekends. And all sorts of things are planned for the future. So, fingers crossed we'll still be here in a few years. And I appreciate you giving us a little attention. We appreciate the word of mouth very much so.
Scott, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you for asking.
Scott Michaels, founder of Dearly Departed Tours. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0285, and you'll find the links to Scott's site.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to science writer Andrew Fizakis about an asteroid near miss, among other things from the world of space science. And Frank Kermit, relationship coach, talks about the minefield that is Valentine's Day. Plus, we also have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now, if you listen to this show on a regular basis, then you know there are some recurring themes when it comes to certain Stuff File news stories. That's because these issues keep coming up time and time again. For instance, as you may know, the rectum is a place for storage of contraband and occasionally for getting things undesirably lodged. Well, in what a National Post reporter believes is a brand new example of the former, a gastroenterologist at Vancouver's St. Paul's Hospital found a vial of urine inside a man who reported to the ER with abdominal pains. According to the doctor's medical journal case description, the rectum was chosen in order to keep the urine at body temperature for an imminent methadone clinic drug test, which, if the urine passed clean, would have entitled the man to the privilege of take-home methadone that he could either bank for later use or sell on the street. The man feared the loss of the privilege, though, if the urine tested at room temperature. You know, you kind of have to be on drugs to come up with some of the ideas that certain folks have managed to conjure up. I mean, really. Moving right along, 60-year-old Rose Ann Bolasny of Great Neck, New York, last year created a trust fund for her 3-year-old Maltese dog, Bellamia, that will allow the spending of $100,000 a year on fashions and spa treatments so that Bolasny can pamper, quote, the daughter I never had, unquote. Bellamia reportedly has 1,000 outfits in her custom-made walk-in closet, including ball gowns, along with diamond and pearl jewelry, and she sleeps in her own double bed. Okay, seriously, why does a dog need a ball gown? Anyway, Bolasny still lives with her husband and has 2 adult sons who are said to be fine with their mother's intentions to will Bellamia a house in Florida if she outlives Bolasny and her 82-year-old husband. Oh, yeah, I'm sure the sons are fine with it. But if Roseanne kicks off, that dog better sleep with one eye open. By the way, let's put this all into perspective, shall we? $100,000 a year in fashion and spa treatments for a dog. The average annual income for a human being in Bangladesh is the equivalent of $380 per year. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. There are people out there with more dollars than cents. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the San Francisco Zoo is bringing Valentine's Day cheer to scorned ex-lovers by allowing them to adopt cockroaches and scorpions in the name of their exes. I love this copy. This Valentine's Day, if you care enough to send the very best, you'll choose our charming Madagascar hissing cockroach package. That's what the zoo said on its website. The zoo suggested the adoption package for the hissing cockroach, which grows to be the size of 2 to 4 inches long and is believed to be the only hissing insect and is the perfect way to show your favorite ex that you have moved on with your life. The zoo also suggested jilted lovers consider adopting a giant hairy scorpion in the name of a low-life ex. So the latest affair didn't work out, and given your ex's record-breaking ability to move on, you suspect foul play? Well, nothing soothes the sting like the adoption of a giant hairy scorpion in honor of your former beloved. It's no surprise these invertebrates are aggressive, active, and alarmingly nocturnal. Much like your low-life ex, they're usually found in and around low-elevation valleys where they dig elaborate burrows or caves. Also, just like you-know-who, when a suitable victim wanders by, the scorpion grabs the doomed creature with its pinchers and stings the prey. After the prey is immobilized, the scorpion tears the carcass apart with its pinchers and begins feeding. Charming. Your Adopt a Giant Hairy Scorpion donation will be used to support these mysterious invertebrates and further the San Francisco Zoological Society's mission to connect people to wildlife, inspire caring for nature, and advance conservation action. We don't make any promises, but urban legend says that the gift of a scorpion adoption serves as permanent protection against future romantic stings. Let the healing begin. Wow. For those whose romantic lives have yet to go horribly wrong, the zoo is offering adoption packages for cuter animals, including snow leopards, penguins, and lemurs. You know, I got to admit, that's some creative marketing. I'm sure there are some people, though, who will misread the zoo's website and will get upset when they discover that they only are adopting cockroaches and scorpions. They can't actually send them to their exes because, you know, some of them would try. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, especially since we're on the topic of Valentine's Day, which is the same topic that our next guest is talking about. Relationship coach Frank Kermit is back on the show. This time around, we're talking about the minefield that is Valentine's Day for both couples and singles, because there's nothing like Valentine's Day to make people uncomfortable. Frank joins us on the line once again from here in Montreal. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us once again. Now, I often refer to a Valentine's Day as a Hallmark Propaganda Day, so you know where I stand on this day as far as its importance in the world is concerned. I was just curious to know how you felt about it.
You know, when you talk about Valentine's Day being a minefield, I do get the criticisms, okay? I do understand it. Couples sometimes feel pressure to do something for their partner. Single people sometimes feel the pressure or feel bad about themselves because they're reminded they're not in a relationship. But that wasn't the spirit of the holiday. And whether it was created by a corporation to make money or it truly was related to various religions or groups that want to celebrate something, I just look at what it is right now. And right now, if you're in a couple, it is a reminder to celebrate what you have with your partner. That's all I see Valentine's Day as. It's a reminder that if you're in a relationship, to take a few minutes, take an evening to appreciate your partner. Now, how you do that is completely up to you. You have advertisements. You have people trying to sell you stuff to give to one another. Slow down. Just because somebody's trying to sell you something doesn't mean you have to buy into it.
Okay, but hold on a second here. Let's, under the old headline of, you know, the cobbler's children go without shoes often, you say that you see Valentine's Day as a reminder, just a reminder of how you love the one in your life. But does your wife see it that way?
In my case, one-on-one, we don't really celebrate holidays per se. If I see a particular thing that I think my wife would like, I will buy it for her regardless of where we are in the calendar. And the same thing goes for her. We're very connected in that. When Valentine's Day does arrive, if we can't do something on the day for one another, we try to do it around that time, but we try to remember to do that every so often anyway. If that particular week we say, you know, it'd be nice for us just to go out to a cheap movie and maybe just spend a few hours together at a nice little restaurant we like, that's something that ideally we would love to do every couple of months. We may not always get the chance to. We're parents. We both have to work. We both have to study. We both have things that we're passionate about. And that's why I see Valentine's Day as a good thing. It's that reminder of, hey, if you haven't done it in a while, you might want to just get back to basics and be mindful of your partner.
But you just brought up also a very, very good point. You said that you and your wife, you do things for each other, buy things for each other, when the spirit hits you at the time that you see something that the other might like, as opposed to being locked into a particular date on the calendar. And from a personal point of view, don't you find that you get a warm, fuzzy feeling when you walk by a store window and you see something that screams your wife to you, as opposed to having to go out obligatory on a time on a calendar when you have to go and get something?
You know, I think that if you put aside outside pressures, anytime you do something for someone when you're happy to do it, you're going to feel that warm and fuzzy feeling. All I see Valentine's Day is a gentle reminder. Now, with that said, sometimes you have people who are in new couples and it's, well, we've been dating for 2 weeks. What do we do for Valentine's Day? What's an appropriate gift? Oh, I hate the pressure. You know, well, maybe that's a conversation topic you should have with the person you're seeing. Hey, I really don't like the pressure of that I'm feeling every time these holidays come around. So, look, what, is there something special you would like to do on that day? Give me some suggestions.
Do you find, I don't know if there's any statistics on this, but are there a lot of breakups between Christmas and Valentine's Day?
There's always going to be massive numbers of breakups around major holidays, and Valentine's Day is no exception. Any holiday, as much as it's a reminder, is also a reflection point. You get to that holiday, and it makes you reconsider, am I happy in this relationship? Is this where I want to be next Valentine's Day? Where was I last Valentine's Day? And am I happy with the person I'm with now? And for that reason, there are a lot of breakups that happen on Valentine's Day. There's also a lot of people who pop the question, propose marriage on Valentine's Day. It's simply a day of reflection. And it can become a very significant date in the lives of people if they choose to take certain actions. So yes, a lot of people do break up on Valentine's Day, but not because of the day, but because any major holiday is a point of reflection and people tend to reassess where they're going with their lives, if they're happy where they are. And if the relationship you're in is satisfying all of your emotional needs, you tend not to worry about that part too much. But if the relationship is not satisfying your emotional needs, and Valentine's Day becomes the day you break up, you didn't break up because it was Valentine's Day. You would have broke up because the relationship is not meeting your needs.
Now, there is the old saying that opposites attract. So if that is indeed the case, what if you're in a relationship and one party is really hung up on Valentine's and the other is not? How do you handle that?
Okay, now for the person who's not hung up on it, there's a distinction to be made. Is it that it's just not that big a deal to them either way, or do they have something against it? We look for the underlying value behind where they stand right now. For the person that is hung up on it, what's the underlying value there? Is the underlying value, all my friends are doing something, so I'm really hung up on this because I want something to show off to my friends, versus I'm really hung up on this because we've been together for so long, and I'm hoping that this is going to be the significant date where the status of our relationship is going to change. So let's look at what the underlying values are. If the underlying values are matched up, then it's okay. If the underlying values are completely at polar opposites, long term does not spell very good success for that particular coupling.
I think another important point you mentioned earlier was the fact that when these traditions started, because you could say the same thing about Christmas. You know, there are people who say that Christmas is too commercial or too this and too that, not religious enough, whatever the case may be, that it's lost its original meaning. Would you say Valentine's Day has, in a way, also had that same thing happen to it?
We would have to look at the history of Valentine's Day, because even something like Mother's Day started out as one woman trying to commemorate the memory of her mother. And then everybody started to do the same thing, not only commemorating that woman's mother, but their own mothers. And then it just took off and became a holiday. And then there are cards, and then there's gifts, and then there's entire marketing campaigns. The bottom line is, and this is where we as a society need to relax, and that is, it doesn't matter what anybody tells you that you have to celebrate. You choose what you celebrate or not. If you have children, there's no rule that says you have to bring up a child in any particular type of religion, type of lifestyle. If you're not a follower of that particular brand of faith, then you don't have to do anything. You have to make a choice as to what you want to do with whatever they're presenting to you. And that is the issue. Not that there's all this pressure on us to buy, not that there's all this pressure on us to celebrate it a certain way, but that we have forgotten that we have a choice in the matter. And if you don't want to celebrate it a certain way, then you don't have to. But you do have to communicate to your partner how you feel about it and your expectations.
And having said that, okay, so let's look at, we just got a couple of minutes here. If somebody is really into Valentine's, two people are into Valentine's and they're in a couple, is there an average, an amount they should spend based on how long they've been in a relationship? Or in other words, can what you spend on Valentine's Day, one way or the other, send the wrong message?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is where communication between the couple is very important. So here are some various examples. Couple number one. They're looking to save up enough money and buy a house. And for that reason, they have agreed not to spend ridiculous amounts on one another on frivolous gifts. So they just decide, look, instead of spending $30 or $40 on things like chocolates and flowers and things that may be overpriced at this time of year, how about we just make a deposit into the fund for the down payment on the house? Another couple might say, look, you know, we don't have a life plan in place per se, but we both enjoy going out, and I want to make Valentine's Day, or we already agreed that Valentine's Day is going to be something where we're just going to go out and have fun, and for that one day, we're not going to think about our debts. Whatever it is the couple decides on, it's a question of, are both individuals in that couple following the same plan that they set out? And if somebody's not following the plan that they set out as a couple, that's the red flag. So that the couple who's spending pennies on their partner, if it's part of the life plan that they've come up with, or if it's part of the plan that they set out in motion, then it's a question of, okay, we agree we wouldn't be spending this kind of money to build a future together, and you just went out and blew $200 on this evening, and yes, it was a nice evening, but that $200 is for our future. Don't you want to have a future with me?
Mm-hmm.
That's the red flag we're looking for. Generally speaking, it's never the surface stuff. It's never the stuff that we see that we would want to look at initially. We always look for the value underneath to tell us the true story about what is going on with the commitment of that couple.
Frank, always a pleasure to talk to you. I should say happy Valentine's to you. People can always find more information by going to your website at franktalks.com. Thanks for being on the program, sir.
Thank you. It was my 10th appearance, and I'm very happy.
Relationship coach Frank Kermit. You can check out his website at franktalks.com to find out about his upcoming events. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0285, and you'll find the link to his site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Does it seem like more schools and cities are shutting down these days because of bad weather? Long before Winter Storm Juno hit the Northeast coast in January, cities and schools in several states were already announcing they'd be closed merely because of the possibility of severe weather. It didn't used to be this way. In the first 10 years of this century, New York City shut its schools only 3 times. However, in the past 5 years alone, it's already exceeded that number. Elsewhere, the University of Michigan hadn't called off classes because of bad weather for 36 years, until last year. It happened only after the college stayed open during a big storm, and some students said the university should be sued for exposing them to harsh conditions. Let's be fair, safety should always be our top priority. But what was once an abundance of caution is now an abundance of fear. The question now is, are schools and cities shutting down because of weather or because of fear of being sued? Share your stories. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, about an asteroid that passed by a little while ago. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day, but I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now, before we get to Andrew. You know, when a dump truck and a municipal bus collided around 1 p.m. on January 5th in downtown Phoenix, it, of course, drew the attention of passengers, bystanders, motorists, and nearby construction workers. According to a report in the Arizona Republic, an unidentified man then immediately seized the moment, ran out from some bushes to the center of the commotion, and flashed the crowd before running away. Well, that has to be the ultimate definition of opportunist. Okay. On to our next guest. Were you concerned about the near miss our planet had from a passing asteroid recently? You really didn't have to duck. And we'll talk about that and some other science issues with Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy and a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. He joins us on the line via Skype-to-Skype communications from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
Always pleasure to have you on the program, sir. So what's the deal with this romantically named 2004 BL-86?
Yeah, I know. You wish these astronomers would come up with something a little more passionate in the naming of it. But yes, this space rock was very interesting. It never posed any danger to us here on Earth. It did pass 1.2 million kilometers away from us at its closest point. But that is considered an astronomical squeaker. It really is, because it is the largest space rock known, at least the ones that are known to us and cataloged, to have passed in a while, and will be so until the year 2027, when another space rock will be coming in our direction. So this was very interesting. It was 3 times the distance that the moon sits from Earth, and it measured approximately 300 meters across, about the size of, I'd say, about the largest cruise ship that we have here on Earth. And it was large enough to be even seen by sky watchers with strong binoculars and small telescopes if they knew where to look in the sky. So it was a very interesting, unique opportunity, and I think NASA learned quite a bit from it.
Now, I understand we're talking about 325 meters in diameter, or 1,066 feet. That's pretty big.
It is, you know, but there are, you know, I mean, if you look at it in concerning, you know, what's out there that hangs around, buzzes around Earth and are considered potentially hazardous objects, there's literally thousands of these out there, and in some cases even millions in some of the smaller sizes. So, you know, when we're talking about potentially hazardous asteroids, these are objects whose path around the sun transect Earth's path. You know, so we've got the orbit, the pathway that each of these objects go. So you have Earth's orb, round orbit around the sun, and then you've got an asteroid's orbit. And if they sort of cross each other, that's a potential danger for Earth. Of course, if we're there at the wrong place at the wrong time, when the two meet, that's obviously the problem. And, you know, luckily for us, astronomers have been surveying a lot of these potentially hazardous asteroids. The ones that Hollywood likes to talk about, the global killers, the ones that kill the dinosaurs, that are 7 to 10 kilometers wide, those ones, 99% of those have been actually cataloged. The ones that are the size of, like the one we're talking about here tonight, the 2004 BL-86, a few hundred meters across, well, we think that something like that hits Earth maybe once every half a million years or so. And but the stuff that really keeps astronomers up at night, I think, and worried, are the real smaller rocks, the ones that are the size of a dump truck or a house, a building, maybe 20 or 30 meters across. We think there's millions of them buzzing around Earth, and we've cataloged maybe less than 1% of what's out there.
Well,
and
you know,
so that's a worry.
Sometimes you're the windshield, and sometimes you're the bug. And by the way, where's Bruce Willis when you need him? Now, the thing that interests me about, again, 2004 BL-86, and we really have to find a better name for it. The thing that interests me is this thing has a moon.
Yeah, exactly. It does have a tiny moon, a miniature moon that seems to be its companion that's following it. And this was visible from the very first images that we got. Some of the world's largest radio telescopes that look like giant dishes. And they bounce off radar signals off the surface of the asteroid as it was passing close to Earth. And it allowed us to map the surface of the asteroid, but what was surprising is that we got to actually see that there was a little smaller rock next to it, a moon. And that was really something that we didn't expect. That one measures about 70 meters across or 230 feet. And this is not completely unusual because we think about 16% of asteroids that are about the size of this one or larger actually have a companion with it. Some even have two moons with it. So this is something very interesting. It was unexpected in this case.
Sort of like a Chester and Spike situation. So at what speed is this thing traveling at?
I mean, we're talking about upwards of 40 to 60,000 kilometers per hour. So it's going very, very quickly. And that's why the approach, when people were looking at it through telescopes, a lot of folks were reporting online that they could actually see the asteroid move in front of the fixed background of stars in the sky. So over a course of say, 10 minutes, it would move over a larger space than what the full moon takes up in the sky. So that's at a pretty good clip, considering that it was three times the distance of the moon when it was at its closest point.
Mm. Interesting stuff indeed. Now, I want to talk a little bit about something else, and I don't just want your scientific ideas of this. I want your actual personal opinion, and that is the idea of the Milky Way being a wormhole.
Yeah, I mean, this really, for me, it's exciting. The idea, the potential of this is exciting simply because I'm a big science fiction fan. I grew up watching Star Trek, for instance. I like watching Stargate. And this idea of being able to travel over immense distances potentially, you know, and sort of do a workaround, you know, Einstein's limit of you know, not being able to travel faster than the speed of light is fantastic. Because, you know, that's one of the big impediments, I think, in the future, looking down the future of humans traveling in the cosmos beyond our solar system is just simply the immense distances. And if we have a wormhole, you know, just like what we saw in the recent movie Interstellar, right, that would really allow us to travel through the Milky Way and beyond, which our current technology would not allow. So it's very exciting for me.
But isn't it slightly far-fetched that one is literally in our own neighborhood? That's the part that I find very surprising.
This is something that, you know, you have to remember this new finding. This is a research paper that really is still in the realm of theory and mathematics. What they think here has happened is they may have evidence that really strengthens the case that there is one of these intergalactic portals that could exist at the heart of our galaxy. And it has to do with understanding some of the observations that we're seeing from the center of our galaxy. What we're seeing occurring in the middle of our galaxy is not really jiving with basically what our theories are. And we can't mesh the two very easily unless we come up with some really bizarre out of this world kind of stuff. And the wormhole theory is actually much more sane than a lot of the other stuff that these astrophysicists are coming up with. It's strange, but it does appear to make sense. Now, next step would be to get some more observational evidence to actually see if this is, could this be real, and bringing it in from theory to reality. That's really the hard aspect of it. How are we going to prove this?
Out of this world theory, indeed. Now, you've got just about a minute, and I want to bring up one more item, and that is that researchers have discovered an ancient replica of our solar system, and they did it via, the Kepler spacecraft?
That's right. The Kepler spacecraft is the premier exoplanet hunter that NASA placed into Earth orbit about 5 years ago. It's kind of hobbled now in its abilities, but it's still doing amazing work. And in this case, they discovered an ancient solar system around a star, again, with a very unromantic name, Kepler 444. But what's interesting, they think it's literally over 11 billion years old, this planetary system that's around the star. That's why that's surprising, 11 billion, because that's nearly double the age of our own solar system. And so that means that when our star was born, you know, this Kepler 444 star system was already older than our sun is.
Okay,
so this is a big deal.
Okay, so if it's a replica solar system, would there be a Goldilocks type planet there that we're looking for?
Well, this is sort of what we're going for. I mean, you have to remember the ultimate goal here is to find Earth 2.0. And that would be a planet that is in this special place where that's called the Goldilocks zone, that represents where water can exist in liquid form. It's not too hot and not too cold. The problem here is that we are not able to really find small planets about the size of ours around distant stars. We're just not there yet in our technological capability. So everything that we've been hearing is really just in the realm of theory right now. Looking at observations of how the star wobbles, looking how the starlight may wink out because of eclipses. We use that as a basis, and then we move from there. So at this point, we're still in the search for Earth 2.0. I don't think it exists in this system, but we're getting much closer.
Interesting indeed. Very busy for the first month of 2015, I must admit. Mr. Vizekas, sir, how can people find you?
People can visit me on my Starstruck column at National Geographic News, where I write weekly notes about what's happening in the sky. They can also reach me at my Yahoo Geekquinox daily articles, science articles, and of course on my website, thenightskyguy.com.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
Andrew Vizekas, the Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. And, of course, you'll find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0285, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Pride comes before a fall. A cocky Texas crook who bragged on Facebook about having 16 historic warrants out for his arrest was detained just hours later after cops were alerted to the post. 22-year-old Eddie Smith thought that he was being seriously clever when he uploaded the provocative status update on January 20th. Here is what he wrote. "So, I have 16 warrants out now. LOL. They know where I'm at, though, so it must not be too bad." But one of his so-called friends, and I'm doing air quotes, on the social network saw the message and ratted him out to the cops. Officers looked up his record and discovered that he wasn't bluffing. They discovered that he had 14 outstanding warrants dating back to 3 years for traffic violations and theft. He also owed more than $1,200 in fines. Smith was tracked down and arrested. He confessed to not having enough money to cover the payments and was jailed for 51 days. Mineral Wells Police Detective Nick Wells said the dad of one had been foolish to mock cops, and I love this quote. He said, "It's one of those things where you can poke fun at a lot of things. Don't poke fun at us. We'll take care of it." Couldn't have said it better myself. But of course, I have to ask the question, why would you go online and brag about the fact that there are multiple warrants out for your arrest? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0285. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0285. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. John's Bay, Vermont. That's it for this show. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.